Okay, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, hello. I'm Jeff Gaudiosi, and you are on MisplacedStraws.com, where music comes to life. It's not often that you get a chance to talk with somebody that has a resume like my next guest. He's the man responsible for perhaps the greatest drum intro ever recorded on Iggy Pop's Lust for Life. He's played with Todd Rundgren, David Bowie, and he's now about to release his first solo record, appropriately entitled Get Your Shit Together, Mr. Hunt Sales. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be welcomed.
Well, and let's start with the new record. After all these years, why is now the right time to put out your debut record?
You know what? Hell if I know. It's a surprise to me, but if you want to know, technically, it was meeting somebody. That means the person from the label, and being offered a deal, and the person that signed me obviously saw something in me worth something, worth, you know, recording, worth promoting, you know, as record companies do. And basically, I did not go looking for this record deal. It was one of those being at the certain place at a certain time and running into someone and them going, hey, do you want to do some recording for us? Yeah. And probably also the other thing that would answer that maybe is where being prepared and then running into an opportunity meet. You know what I mean? The cross-section of preparation and opportunity. So I've been recording for years. I've been writing music for years, on my own, that is. So ending up getting a record out, well, that's, like I said, meeting Bruce Watson from Fat Possum and him knowing something about me and then him offering me, you want to make a record? And yeah, so.
Why not?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know. At my age, going to record labels, if they would say, God, we've been looking for a 64-year-old person to sign. You know what I mean? That's kind of like a little strange.
And now, well, this is a straight-up rock and roll record, and it really brings together, you know, that Austin guitar sound where you're based now, but as well as, you know, the New Orleans horns and the Memphis blues. Who worked with you on the record? You know, who was the band that helped you put it all together?
I guess this guitar player was, we worked together for quite a while. His name is Charco Jean. It was him and me, and then this bass player that was with me for a little bit has done some work with me, a guy named C from Austin. He's no longer with me, but basically Charco and myself have been recording and doing sporadic gigs for quite a while in Austin, and not regularly, maybe a gig a year, maybe two gigs a year. And a lot of sitting in rooms rehearsing and working on music, you know, basically. And then there's a few horn players and stuff I got out of Memphis that I'd met and brought them in to kind of add to whatever I was, you know, whatever I've done on the record. So I don't know if that answers it.
Yeah, I say it's a... I find it just a really interesting record because it does have that geographic sound that, like, the old records used to have. You know, you used to know when a band was from New York or L.A. or down south. And to me, right, just the sound of this record really screams, you know, the South with Austin and New Orleans and Memphis. I don't know if you've ever worked with them, but I got a real Alejandro Escovedo feel from the guitar and vocal on this. It's definitely an interesting record.
Thank you. I've worked with him. We've done some gigs years ago with Will Sexton, me and Alejandro. We did a little 3-day tour, I remember years ago. But my musical influence is all over the place as far as what I've grown up listening to and what I like. You know, anything from jazz to Zydeco to country, blues, and soul. And the sound, technically, if you were to say of the record, probably sounds somewhere between a Stax, old Stax record, and maybe a Motorhead record or, stuff from Lust for Life or whatever.
Exactly, and oddly enough, it all works when you put it together like that. You know, on paper it shouldn't, but it definitely does.
Well, you know how we have this thing, like, years ago, like, especially in Nashville, where they would take some 70s rock and let's add this, and it's like they add all these combinations that are really, that don't work. So when you say it like it's on paper, yeah, let's take all the worst stuff we've ever heard, put it together, and make some more stuff that sounds like shit. But you hear the influences, and it's the horns mixed in with the other stuff, and kind of a Fats Domino thing. But to say that, it's not Fats Domino, but you hear that influence.
Right, right. And your lyrics, it's an intensely personal record. More than a few songs deal with your history with drugs. The song One Day really kind of addresses the loss of your parents. What did it mean to you to be able to get your story out in your own words?
Well, the song One Day, I make reference to my parents, but also the lyrics in that song make reference to things like, besides missing people, like one, you know, the person that says, I'm going to give up cigarettes, or I'm going to stop eating donuts, or I'm going to try to be nicer to my wife or husband or whatever, or, you know, I'm going to clean up that room, whatever you keep putting off. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Putting things off.
One day you'll get to it.
And exactly. And that's really what that song is about. Now, I do mention the loss or missing my mom or dad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mentioned that in it, but it's really not about that. Because
right.
I miss that. I miss them like we all miss our parents. I miss a lot of other people that have passed away, whether I've known them or not. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the song is kind of universal because it is about loss, and it's probably also about one day let me get to doing this. There's some stuff I've been putting off. You know what I mean? And that is a pretty universal thing, wouldn't you say? Like putting things off. When I wrote that song, I was like, God. And it's a song that probably has been written before. I mean, in a different way by other people, you know what I mean? And maybe I'm saying it a little different, but it's, you know, it's nothing original, but it's about loss. It's about putting things off. It's about doing things that maybe I need to do. And in that way, it's kind of universal.
Yeah. And, you know, after you wrote these songs, and I mean, I know you said you've been writing for years and then finally put the record together. When you went back and looked at some of them, did you think that they may have gotten a little too personal into your history or dealt, you know, a little too much with, you know, your past vices and abuses? Or did you say, you know, whatever, this is the song, it's going out there?
Some things, it's like people know about me and worldwide, and I've got a reputation like a lot of people, or some people, maybe nobody knows about me. A lot of people don't know who I am, and people know who I am, and they don't know this, they don't know that. I'm not ashamed, and I don't really, you know, live in regrets, but I wrote some stuff that's personal in there. Yeah, of course I did. And of course it doesn't change the price of a loaf of bread at the store, nothing. But I write about what I know about. I can write in the third person. I've written stuff like that. This song, yeah, deals with a lot of drugs and sex and stuff like that, you know. And I was trying to keep it real. And I have to write about those things. And not that there's not other things. I write about personal things, you know, like we talked about the one day about loss and about getting to do things that maybe I haven't done. And then, yeah, there's drug references and things about drugs. I don't know. Any of it resonate with you at all?
Well, you know, it's weird because I think even though a lot of it was personal to your story, I think the themes of it resonate universally. You know, it may not have gone through the same things you did, but I think if you really sit and listen, you understand what you're saying, and everyone has gone through some, you know, can find themselves in the story. And I think that's a really, you know, rare thing when it comes to songs. And sometimes the more personal they are, the more universal they become.
Yeah. You know, I was this doctor I was seeing, and it's a while back, and I was at the time strung out. And this doctor said to me, you know, they didn't know me that well, they knew me well enough, but they said, you know, everybody's got something that they're dealing with. You may be dealing with this, and I was, but you know, whether it was like they're eating too much, or they have a thing, a sex problem, or they have a money issue, or they have a self-esteem issue, or they have a anger issue. You know what I mean? Everybody's got something, don't they? And in that way, that is universal. So, you know, it's just like everyone, you grow up and you go, geez, my family is so fucked up. But it isn't until you get older and you meet other people and you go, yeah, really? Your dad was like that, or your mom, or your brother, or your sister was like, you know what I mean? And then the similarities in life are just so, not the differences, the similarities are so close.
And I think that's why music really brings everyone together, because if you're looking for it, you can find your story in any song you listen to.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, going back, you know, through your history a bit, you and your brother Tony, you guys had some early success with your own band, but you really began to hit it with Todd Rundgren on Runt. Once and for all, can you settle the debate? Was Runt a band or was Runt a Todd solo project?
It was his solo record, but what it was there was some, I believe, unless I'm just completely wrong, and I don't think I am, that there was some chemistry going on. Opposed to if he had made that record, and I don't know because he didn't, but if he had made that record and had hired a session drummer and a session bass player, would it have been that record? Or would it have been a different version of that record, right?
Oh, I mean, I think to me that's my favorite Todd record, and it's the chemistry between you guys as a unit, I think, that really brings those songs to life.
Yeah. So, and that's not to take anything whatsoever away from Todd as being, you know, so creative and such a great artist that he is. But it definitely has a chemistry to it. And that record came out of meeting him and jamming with him at a club in New York prior to leaving New York, moving from New York. And we met him at this club called Steve Paul Scene. Met him and jammed with him. And it was like, wow, what was that? And then we sat down and talked. And he said, man, I got a record deal. He had left the NAS and got his own solo deal. And I remember telling him, well, next month we're moving back to California after living in New York for quite a while. He said, well, I'm going to come out to California. I want to do the record out there. He came out to California, stayed at our house. We had a house, extra bedroom, and he stayed with us, and we kept jamming. He wrote a bunch of material, and we ended up recording. So you go on to something when you mention that, like you hear a difference compared to, I don't mean better or worse, any of that, but that it had a little flavor of some chemistry going on.
Yeah, and I think you kind of see that, you know, in the follow-up for the Ballad of Todd Rundgren, where you weren't as involved. And again, not for better or worse, but there's just a different sound. Why weren't you as involved in the follow-up?
I don't know. You know, that's a great question, or a good question. I did like one or two tracks on that record, and he had another drummer he was working with. Maybe he felt the other drummer was, he was an older guy than me, a guy named Indy Smart, I think a Nashville session drummer, and maybe he felt, well, this guy's more of a professional. I have no clue. You know what I mean? I have no clue.
It's the music business.
Well, it's, you know, people, they want to do this, they want to do that, and it was Todd Rundgren's record, and I guess he felt deemed to do whatever, you know, what he thought. I don't know what he thinks. I have no idea. I never will. I don't care. But I remember just doing a track or two on that, and okay, fine. At the time, I didn't get it, but looking back now, it could have been, you know, the guy was older than me. Was he better than me? What does better mean? Was he different than me? Yeah, he was different than me. He didn't play like I played. So, you know, it brought him what it brought him. You obviously noticed a difference, right?
Oh, definitely. And I can say, it's not to say better or worse, it's just to say different. Yeah.
Different. And I don't know, those words you use, good, bad, better. And it's just different. You know, it's just, it was just different, but it's interesting that you see that, you know, and you hear that in it.
And then after Todd, you had a short-lived project with Bob Welch of Fleetwood Mac, which was definitely interesting, before teaming up with your brother again for those classic Iggy sessions. You did the demos, became Kill City, and then came back for Lust for Life. How did that partnership with Iggy begin, and, you know, did David Bowie come in after you guys had joined with Iggy, or was it all sort of...
No, well, here's... We met David in New York. He was playing Radio City Music Hall with the Spiders from Mars when he was doing that. And we were with Todd in New York. And that's why I met David at Nexus Kansas City. So years later, James Williamson, who was in the Stooges, was a friend of ours, just a friend. And, yeah, we did the Kill City, a couple tracks for that. But David had gotten Iggy a record deal with RCA and recorded a record called The Idiot. And then it was time for them to tour, and they called my brother and I up to tour that, you know, to promote that record that the two of them had done somewhere in Europe. And that started my association. I had met Iggy before in Los Angeles. He was kind of on the down and out at that point. You know, he wasn't doing too well. And then David came in to his life again, took him over to Europe, to Berlin, got him a record deal with RCA, and then there comes us. We got involved in promoting the first record. We toured with David playing keyboards, and then after that tour, not long after the tour promoting The Idiot, we went in the studio with David and Iggy and did Lust for Life, and then did one more tour with Iggy minus David, and that's when Scott Thurston came in, who was with the Stooges and then later with Tom Petty.
That was the Heartbreakers, yeah.
Yep.
What's your memory of being in the studio recording that iconic drum intro, The Lust for Life. I mean, it's in every commercial you watch on TV, even to this day. You know, what do you remember about putting that together?
I remember there was a drum beat that was on Armed Forces Radio that we used to listen to, Armed Forces Radio in Berlin. You know what I mean? And it had this weird kind of drum beat that was similar to the cartoon George of the Jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And that beat is somewhere between George of the Jungle and then the Supremes, You Can't Hurry Love.
It's funny, now like that you mentioned George of the Jungle, I'm hearing that in my head, and I'm like, that's the exact beat. Never put that together before.
Okay, so it's somewhere between George of the Jungle, this Armed Forces Radio. Armed Forces, it's a radio station, you know, the Armed Forces Radio. And then the early Supremes Motown. They've got, you know, You Can't Hurry Love. And it's a mishmash of all that, maybe a little bit of Sandy Nelson. He was a drummer. And Cozy Cold did a record, Topsy, whatever it was called. A bunch of stuff from the past, you know, just kind of mishmashed together. And then the song and then, you know, just kind of coming together. But it was a bunch of those different influences because I don't know what's original except one's interpretation is original. You know what I mean? As far as music goes.
It's all how you use it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and me being a, I can say personally about myself, I can speak for myself, coming up, being playing jazz, and then being exposed to jazz drummers, personally knowing them and seeing them do gigs, whether it was, you know, Art Blakey or Buddy Rich, Shelly Manne, Elvin Jones. And that was my biggest influence, these guys. There's a drummer that I got started when I first started playing. This is the first drummer that I really noticed. I went to a recording session at 6 years old. Between 6 and 7, and his name was Earl Palmer. And Earl Palmer played on, I guess, the Little Richard stuff, a lot of the early, and he was doing a recording session for my father. He was one of the musicians. My dad did comedy singing records back, you know, in his early 60s.
Oh, your father is the legendary Soupy Sale.
Right. When I went to that session, and I saw Earl Palmer play, and I went, God, that's what I want to do. It wasn't Ringo or any of these, you know, the British Invasion or that. It was Earl Palmer. And then being exposed to jazz. Then there was the surf music that was real big on the West Coast. Then the British Invasion came, of course. But that's what got me into drumming was Earl Palmer, seeing him at a recording session at 6.5 years old, and then I started drumming. I started attempting to play the drums and take drum lessons at 6.
You know, as a kid, you know, getting the opportunity to be exposed to people like that, I mean, did you realize that you were in the room with Earl Palmer or Buddy Rich, or were they just like these cool guys that were teaching you how to play drums?
Well, in the very beginning, I mean, when I was little, I'm sure, you know, what's it like your dad, you know, being such a star? My dad was a star, but to me, he was my father. I knew things were a little bit different because to see my father, I remember if I wanted to see my father a lot of the time when I was very little, I remember at 5 years old, I'd have to turn on TV to see him. Because he wasn't around a lot. He was working. So imagine to see your dad every day. You wake up and go downstairs and turn on TV to see your dad.
Yeah.
Now, that's, I don't know how many people have that experience.
Yeah, how many could really?
No, so, but that's like normal. That becomes like the norm. Just like, and I knew this was a big deal. But still, coming out of my living room and Frank Sinatra's there, okay?
Wow.
or you know, I remember a friend of mine at school, really, we were friends when I was little, and his father used to pick us up, and I'd go up to his house and play with him, and I was a little later, I was like 9, 8, and his dad was Charlton Heston. Now, I remember seeing Charlton Heston, you know, biblical movies, you know what I mean?
And stuff.
Yeah. And here I am in an ex-KEJ with his son and me, and we're going up to their crib to hang out. So I knew, like, this was definitely different, but nevertheless, I don't know. I mean, you know, my reality is definitely, I mean, still it's still dad and mom, no matter how weird they were. But it still was like, you know, mom and dad, you know what I'm saying? So my reality is definitely, yeah, my dad did not sell insurance. No, he didn't. And he drove really nice cars. But one thing I had going for me that was good, I believe, at the time I probably didn't appreciate it, but my father raised me the way he was raised. My father's from Huntington, West Virginia, which means I bought my own car. I was on my own at 15. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I was not born with a silver spoon in my ass or whatever. You know what I mean? I made my own way.
Yeah.
I come from a broken family. My dad left when I was 12 years old. Okay. So my experience is not unlike a lot of kids, people that come from a broken home. But, you know, you look back at stuff, and it was normal, and then it was not. But I definitely have never had an entitlement problem. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now, getting back to the music a bit,
Yeah,
after you finished with Iggy, there was about a decade or so before the start of Tin Machine. Did you keep in touch with David over that period? How did Tin Machine come to be?
I was in Austin, Texas, producing what I used to do for a while. I was on and off playing and then arranging and producing, working on sessions, producing, doing session work, producing things for people. You know what I mean? Independent stuff, Triple X Records, different labels and independent people. And I was in Austin working on a record for this label back in the 80s. This would be late 80s, Amazing Records. And I got a phone call from my brother. My brother had run into David at a party. It was like a rap party for the Glass Spider tour. And I hadn't seen David in years. And nor had my brother. My brother ran into him, and he said, "Oh my God, da da da!" And I was thinking about you. He said, "Where's the drummer? Get the drummer." So my brother calls me up and says, "Look, I ran into David. We ain't coming back to L.A." I said, "Oh, about a week or so." He said, "Okay." So I come back to L.A. and me, my brother, and I and David get together and jam in a rehearsal room, you know, a rehearsal room in L.A. And we all had some ideas and stuff. And I think David was ready to do something different. He mentioned he had met this guitar player, Reeves Cabrell. So next thing I know, we came up with a lot of first Tin Machine records just jamming that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then David calls and says, "Hey, I want you to come over to Switzerland." That's where he was living. So my brother and I went to Switzerland. And David is using a studio over there. And Reeves shows up, and it's like, you know, a couple of teenagers in a garage, but we're in this really nice studio, and it's not a bunch of teenagers. We're all a bit older. But it's kind of a leftover. Part of it was from David, my brother, and I playing with Iggy, doing that tour and that record, minus Iggy. Right?
Right.
So it was kind of a holdover from that. We're all a little bit older now, and we don't have Iggy around. So let's really have some fun. And then meeting Reeves
And what Reeves brought into that band is just a different sensibility on guitar. And being from Boston and everything, his just his whole vibe. And after we sat in the studio for like a week or so, and we're writing all this stuff in the studio because all of us had experience working on a lot of records, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to go into the studio and just write a song or two a day or three a day and then record them. And after about a week, we just start accumulating a bunch of material. And this is not a David Bowie record. This is not my record.
Yeah, it's a band.
No, it's a band. It's not my record. It's not a Reeves Cabral record or a Tony Sales. This is like a band. So it's kind of organically coming together. You know, the front guy's worth $100 million, but despite that, it's like I'm not there working for anybody. I hadn't been hired to do anything, and it was a band. It turned into a band. Next thing we know, we're sitting there thinking up names, and the name Tin Machine comes up, and I go back to L.A., and about a month later, we go back over there and record another 20 or 30 songs. Now, this is starting to turn into something, and next thing we know, it's we have the record done, and now we're excited, and let's, you know, let's move on with this. This is happening. Really, I remember coming back to California and someone saying, what are you doing? And I said, we got this band. My brother, me, this guitar player, Reeves, and David. And they'd look at me like I'm lying. You know how people go like, yeah, I'm working with it. People bullshit. They'll go like, yeah, not now, but years ago. What are you doing? Oh, I'm working with Prince. And that, you know, people talk, you know. I stopped telling people about this because they looked at me like I'm bullshitting them. I got this band and David's singing. They'd look at me like, yeah, good, have a good day. Fucking liar. I swear to God. But then we came out with the record and everybody's like mind was blown. You know what I mean? Some people could not accept him being in that band, Tin Machine. You know what I mean? It was really a split thing. Either people went, God, this makes sense. This is great. I love the music. Or other people were like, this sucks. I like Let's Dance and da-da-da and this and that. And you know, literally, people would come to interview Tin Machine. They would not speak to the other three of us. They would direct every question to David. So...
Yeah, well,
it went both ways.
You know, it's fine. I will freely admit, you know, Bowie is my all-time favorite. So when Tin Machine came out, I was all in from the beginning. And I got to say, listening to Tin Machine 2, I was stunned to hear your vocal on Sorry and Stateside, simply because I would think it takes a brass set of balls to grab the mic when you got David Bowie in the room. And I give you all the credit in the world for doing that. You know, what led to you getting a vocal on that record?
Well, without sounding like a complete asshole, because I'm a badass.
Well, I think you have to be to get the mic.
Well, I mean, look, I don't want to take anything away from anybody, but... First and foremost, I told you my early childhood. My father's a legend, okay? Now, of course, David Bowie, superstar legend. We all know that. Great, great entertainer, you know, great songwriter. But I've been playing since I'm 6 years old. I went professional at 11 years old, okay? I've been in the music game longer than David, okay? As far as making records and stuff. Now, I'm no David Bowie. No,
right.
I'm not. That's not the point. The point I'm making is that great musician, great writer, David, you know, everything. I mean, you know, who doesn't know that? But I have my own set of nuts. And to me, all the bands I've played in that nobody knows, all the soul bands, all the different bands in the ghettos, jazz bands, organ trios, everything that I had done, that's where I was coming from.
what makes somebody, you know what I liked about David? I'll tell you the thing I really liked about him. He could be a very sweet, warm person. Okay, forget the records he sold and songs he wrote. As a person. And to me, I've been around a lot of, you know, weird fucking crazy shit and worked with some fucking weird people. And that thing, you know, going back to 76, 77, hanging out with him. And I remember one day spending a day with him at the park, in some park in Berlin with his son, who was like 6 years old at the time. And that's how I know him, okay, from him helping Iggy out and just and being in the band with Iggy. Now, he was behind the scene helping Iggy, yeah, but he was like in the band with us, you know what I mean?
Right.
And okay, so we were backing up Iggy. And then comes Tin Machine, which I wasn't hired to work for David. So it was like we could all like, you know what I liked about that idea, David? He'd say, what? And I'd say nothing, and he would laugh. You'll see videos with all of us fucking with each other. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So whether I'm singing with whatever gig, singing with David Bowie, singing with whatever, I try to hold my own. You know what I mean? And, you know, I've been on stage since I was 11 years old. So by the time I hit David Bowie, what was I, 40? You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, there was no intimidation there with the way it was all set up.
I wouldn't say so. I'm sitting in my living room at the age 9 or 10. My father being it, you know? So.
Yeah.
I'm not that guy. I'm not saying that, wow, David, great that I'm not, you know, impressed by some of the music that he has written. Music. But he also did some music that was beneath him, I feel. Okay?
Yeah.
Can you agree with that or not?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at Tonight.
Yeah, so, I mean... Yeah. I don't know if it's having a father and being in the second-generation business that I would view him no different than I view anybody as a person.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't my first being with him. Yeah, it was something special, but it wasn't my first rodeo. You know
right.
what I'm saying? Like, I'd been around... And regardless to how rich he was or how famous he was, it was a band. So,
yeah. And it came through. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like we're talking about Todd, you know, you have a chemistry, you've got this thing going back to 76, 77, and us hanging out. And one of the guys, I mean, yeah, one of the guys happens to be worth $50 million, but... I saw that shit as a youngster. You dig what I mean? So I'm easily impressed by people, how they carry themselves and if they're cool, regardless to if it's, you know, my neighbor down the block who delivers refrigerators to David Bowie. I don't, you know, I mean, seriously.
And now,
you know,
the story has always been that Tin Machine dissolved in part due to David having an issue with your drug use. Is that accurate? You know, would there have been more or did it run its course?
First of all, Tin Machine put out its first record. And we were supposed to do a 3-month tour after the first record came out. But instead of doing that, we did a week and a half promotional tour because David went for a $50 million guarantee to do one of those bullshit farewell tours. You know what I'm saying?
I remember. Yep.
And it was financially and businessly motivated by the people who were working with him. And at the time, I went to him and said, I'm far from anyone to say, you know, don't go make $50 million. You know, that's ridiculous. But I think you could probably make more than that. And he said, you know, it's funny you said that. Someone else told me that. And there was nothing I could do about it. And that kind of fucked up the first record, okay, him doing that. Because it put Tin Machine off for about 8 months, 7 months. Right. And David had his own problem in the beginning of Tin Machine with substance, okay? And though I used, I showed up to did my work. I was a now I'm not trying to make myself out anything except I was a functioning addict, okay? But who wasn't? So
yeah, the late 80s, very true.
He ends up halfway through Tin Machine getting sober. And, you know, people get sober and they get some crazy ideas, okay? And he could call it that, but I think it's a cheap shot. I didn't miss any gigs. I didn't miss any sessions, and I showed up and worked. So I remember the last gig driving back, and it was in Tokyo. Went to Japan for a month, a little under a month. And I looked at him, and I said, I really fucked up the tour, didn't I? He said, no, you didn't. And I said, good, fuck you. And he laughed. So you know what? I'm not going to blame anybody for not wanting to be around someone who drinks or uses drugs. It's a horrible habit. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it is. It's some horrible shit, and I've gone through it. And, you know, I can sit here today having gone through it.
Come out the other side and can talk about it.
Yeah, I can talk about it. And you know what? But I showed up and did my work, and I didn't hang anybody up, and I didn't involve anybody in my shit. That's because, you know, it's he can blame it on that if he wants, but, I mean, there's an awful lot of shit I could talk about, and I ain't going to talk about it, that I know, and things that I know. So it's a cheap shot, and he wanted to go. I told him, don't turn out and be like Chubby Checker.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think David, the last few records he made were brilliant. And I think after Tin Machine, he made a lot of records that were not very good. I don't know if you agree with me or not.
Yeah, I definitely agree with a few of those, yep.
Well, I didn't stay with him because it was a band. My brother didn't stay with him because it was a band. Reeves Cabrel stayed with him. Yeah. And I don't know if that helped him or hurt him, okay? So I thought the last record he made was so good, and maybe one before that. I'm not sure, you know. And the guy, what an incredible talent. You know, just incredible, okay? And that can't be taken away. And it's not my opinion. It's what I know from being around musicians and all kinds of people. But as far as doing the kind of work that I thought he was capable of doing, and I know everyone doesn't that whatever all the time, but I heard a lot of great work out of the guy, and then I heard a bunch of shit out of him. And seriously,
I think when you've been around that long, that you know you're going to have plenty of both in your career.
Possibly, possibly. Though I've heard very little Nina Simone records I don't like. I like most of them. You know what I mean? And that goes for Art Blakey, and that goes for, but you're right, you know, I mean, I guess Bob Dylan and a few people have made some stuff that's not as good as it should be, but I don't know, you know what I mean, that's just a moot point, maybe.
Yeah. Now, have you been approached by any of there's a couple competing tours of Bowie alum that are going around the world at various times. Have you ever been approached by any of those people to join up?
I was hit on a few years ago about doing a Tin Machine tour and getting someone else to sing, right? Mm-hmm. And my answer was to find another drummer. David's gone. That's the end of Tin Machine. And
right.
I'll tell you something. I used to sit around with David, and we would laugh about people and things. And some of these people are out there, you know, doing his songs. So I would never do that. You know what? Yeah. I'll write my own songs. I'll do my own
exactly.
thing. I'm not gonna write off the back of him. And I think this is just my opinion. I think it's a bunch of shit. Okay? You know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. Now, so much of your career has been linked with your brother's rhythm section. What's the relationship like with your brother now? Did you reach out to him at all for the new record?
No, I didn't. And I've had my own bands for years, okay? Mm-hmm. Nobody knows about them. They're on the internet. I had a band, a 10-piece band years ago in the 80s, Hot Sales and the Big Nine. I've had other bands over the years. Just nobody knows about it, under the radar stuff. And Tin Machine was the last thing with my brother.
Right.
And it's nice having my brother as my brother rather than working with him right now. Mm. You know what I mean?
Oh, definitely.
We can have a relationship. It's very hard, you know. Yeah. We worked for years together. And it's not that I wouldn't work with him. I would. But I'm just... you know, doing what I'm doing my own thing. And
what's next for you? I know you have a show coming up in Austin at the end of January for the record release, and I should say it comes out January 25th, called Get Your Shit Together. Will there be a tour? Do you have a band put together to get on the road, or what's next for you?
Well, I've been rehearsing. And, I got a band together. I got Charco Jean, who's on the record, guitar player, who's been playing with me for quite a while. And I got two other people, Michael Archer, bass player, and another guitar player named Dave Biller. They're from here, Austin. They live here. Mm-hmm. And we've been rehearsing, and... hopefully, we'll get on the road, I'm hoping, in the next couple months. Probably West Coast, probably first we'll do a West Coast tour. I'm going to try to do the West Coast or the East Coast. I'm not sure right now. You know what I mean? I'd first get the record out and see what happens. And with that, and it's either we'll hit the States or we'll go to Europe. So I don't, at this point, I'm not sure what's going on. We have this record release thing coming up, which would be good to do again, you know, and then we have we're doing an in-store, which would be funny because it's in-store. They usually do acoustic stuff, and we'll be showing up with Marshall Stacks. So I hope the windows don't break. But
thank you so much for the time. It's been just an honor to be able to talk to you. I've been a fan of, you know, your work from the beginning. So, it really, really is great to get a chance to talk with you. When you do have any plans to get on the road, let me know. We'll get it out there for you. It's a great record. I definitely encourage everyone to check it out and give it a listen.
Thank you so much.
It's a great rock and roll record that you don't get much of these days. So it's good to
hear. Thank you. That's a great compliment. And let me thank you for the support. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So best of luck with the record. Hopefully we can catch you when you come around the East Coast here. And, hopefully we'll hear from you soon.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Hunt.